You explained last week the inyan of hiddur mitzvah and noi mitzvah, of doing mitzvahs in an appealing, aesthetically appealing way, and not the opposite. We said even though to the Rabbanu Shalom doesn't make any difference, right, there's nothing you can do that the Rabbanu Shalom cares one way or the other if the animal is, what you're bringing as a sacrifice is a baal mum or not a baal mum, but it affects us and our feelings about our relationship with the Rabbanu Shalom are changed by what we see and how we relate to a mitzvah, if it's appealing positively in a in an aesthetic way, then we give more cover to the mitzvah. We relate to it in a more positive way. On the other hand, if it's something that's disgusting or not appealing or whatever, it affects us. So the effect is mostly for us, not so much for how it affects the Rabbanu Shalom for sure. And even though we said there is an argument whether Zekeli Van Vehu is an idea of beautifying HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the only way you can beautify HaKadosh Baruch Hu is by beautifying his mitzvahs, or it's be affected by the beauty of the mitzvahs, right? We said the nafkamina would be, the difference would be, if you have a gartel for a Sefer Torah, that one side is silk and the other side is plain. So it's a machlokas which side you put towards the Sefer Torah, right? According to the idea that you're supposed to beautify the mitzvah as beautifying the Rabbanu Shel Olam, then you put the silk side towards the Sefer Torah, because you're beautifying the Torah itself. But if the idea is how it impresses us, obviously you put the silk side on the outside so people see that the silk is there. But it doesn't mean that you're trying to do it for the sake of the Rabbanu Shel Olam. But how you relate to the mitzvah, if you relate to the mitzvah in an honorable way, it makes the mitzvah more honorable. So if you put the silk side towards the Sefer Torah, you show that you feel the Sefer Torah is fit for something more pretty, more refined. So then you approach and relate to that Sefer Torah in a different way. On the other hand, the other way is also there. If you see a Sefer Torah with a nice silk gartel, it gives you more of an honor, of a feeling of appreciation for the Sefer Torah. So both of them are for the sake of the person who's doing it. Question is the idea what you're affected by, what you see, or the way that you do it? In any case, with this concept that people are affected by what they see, what they sense, and makes an impression on us, and therefore if you see something that's appealing aesthetically, it makes more of an impression than something that's not appealing aesthetically. It gives you more of an impression of covet for that thing. I wanted to explain once a question they ask on a Ramban. The Ramban, there's an argument exactly what Olam Haba is. Tiyas HaMesim, Olam Haba. The Rambam learns that Olam Haba and Tchias HaMesim are two separate things. That Olam Haba is a totally spiritual world, and Tchias HaMesim is a world where the body and soul will be reunited, but only temporarily. So it's a point in history, for whatever reason. That's not the now we want to go into and discuss why the Rambam holds that it's important to have a resurrection of the dead, but that's not Olam Haba. Olam Haba will be when those souls that are put back in the body temporarily will once again go back to a spiritual world, and that will be Olam Haba. Olam Haba is a spiritual world that exists now, according to the Rambam. It's only called Olam Haba because it comes after you die, but not because it's a world to come that isn't around now. It's called the world of Nefashos, Gan Eden, whatever we call it. It exists now, and that's where the Neshamas are now, and that's where they eventually will be eternally. But between now and the final stage of the world, when all neshamas will be in a spiritual world, there's going to be a time when there'll be a resurrection of the dead. That's the Rambam. The Ramban argues, and he says that Olam Haba and Tchias HaMesim are the same thing. Tchias HaMesim will be in Olam Haba. It'll be a physical and spiritual world, in other words, the body and the soul. except it'll be a new world which will be made to accommodate eternal bodies and souls. So they ask on the Ramban that it says that the description of Olam Haba is Ein lo achila v'lo shtia, right? There's no eating, there's no drinking. It seems to be like the Rambam, that it's a totally spiritual world. So the Ramban answers, there won't be eating and drinking. That doesn't mean that a person won't have a body. Moshe Rabbeinu had a body, and he went up to Har Sinai for 40 days and 40 nights. He didn't eat and he didn't drink. So you see, it's possible to have a body that doesn't need to eat and need to drink. So in Olam Haba, by after Trias HaMesim, which will be Olam Haba, where the body and the soul will be reunited eternally, the body won't need to eat and drink. It'll be a body that doesn't need to eat and drink. So they ask on the Ramban, if that's the case, what do you need a body for? Right? If the body's not going to serve the purposes that a body serves in this world, the purpose of the body in this world is to give the neshama an ability to exist in a physical world. So you need a physical plant for it to exist in, like a candle. Right? The flame needs a physical thing to connect to. So you need the wax candle or the oil or whatever, and the wick or whatever. But if the neshama is going to be able to exist without bodily functions, you're not going to have to eat and drink. Then what do you need a body for? That's the question they ask on the Ramban. So what's the purpose of the body? So based on what we said last week, the body, or the gashmius in this world, serves two purposes. The first purpose is to create the atmosphere and environment for the spiritual to take place. Okay? That you need your body to give a place for the neshama to exist. It arouses various emotions. We said motions create emotions. Going through the motions create emotions. So that's the purpose of the body in this world. And then the body also serves the purpose of expressing those emotions in a physical, gashmiistic way, a material way. And we said that with expressing emotions in a concrete, physical way is a much higher level than those emotions just being spiritual. And we based it on the Ramban. And also the Ramban says on the Pasuk, Mato'iru, Mato'oru, Esa'ava, Elshetechbats, if you have lofty emotions of love, fear, whatever it may be, don't just leave them floating in the air. Achetechbats, put them into something concrete, into a chefetz. Right? Quantify them in some physical representation, represent them with something physical, put them into some physical environment, and then they're more real. So the Ramban, if you feel tremendous simcha, dance. Right? So you'll express that simcha in a physical way. We said that therefore, like dancing on Simchas Torah, it serves two purposes. One, to arouse you to simcha, because going through the motions helps you to reach those emotions. And once you have that simcha, the dancing helps you to express it in a physical way. So it's on both ends. And we said that was the aron. The aron was gold on the outside and gold on the inside and wood in the middle. And you have the what's it called? You have to put the gold outside first, and then it leads to the inside, and then you again put it on the rim on the outside, meaning that first you arouse the emotions physically, then you get the emotions, and then you express them physically. So on both ends you have the physical world. And that's what the Ramban holds also. In this world, the body is needed for two purposes. One, for arousing emotions and spirituality and giving the neshama a place to be able to exist, right, in a physical world. And therefore the body has to eat and drink and do all the bodily functions that creates an environment for the neshama to be able to exist, like a flame on a candle. But in the next world, just the opposite. The neshama will give life to the body, not the body to the neshama. The neshama will be able to exist in this new Olam Haba, which is more attuned to neshamos, without the body giving it life. The neshama will give life to the body. but the body will give the neshama the ability to express itself in a concrete way. So the purpose there of the body is to let the neshama express itself in a physical, concrete way. Whereas in this world, the body gives the neshama existence and expresses the neshama physically. In that world, the neshama will give the body existence, but the body will give the neshama a way of expressing itself. And with that idea, I want to explain a Gemara in Brachos. The Gemara says that when the Rabban Shem told Moshe Rabbeinu to build the Mishkan, so Moshe Rabbeinu understood that he's first to build the Kelim, the vessels of the Mishkan, and then the Mishkan itself. And when he told Bezalel that was what God had told him, okay, the Rabban Shem, Bezalel said, "You must be making a mistake. That can't be what God said, because that's not the way of the world. People don't build their furniture and then build a house around it, right? If you build the furniture and don't have the house, where are you going to put it? Must be that God told you first to build a Mishkan, the plant, the building, and then the Kelim, the vessels." So Moshe Rabbeinu said, "You know, you're right. And you were Betzel Kel, you were in the shadow of God, and you knew that that's what he meant. And that's why he was called Bezalel." So it's obviously a very, very difficult Gemara. First of all, how could Moshe Rabbeinu make a mistake? He thought the Ribbono Shel Olam said, first build the Kelim and then the Mishkan, and Bezalel caught a mistake. If that's the case, maybe Moshe Rabbeinu made mistakes other places, nobody caught him. Right? Who knows if we got the Torah without mistakes? So it's impossible to say that. Right? Obviously, if Moshe Rabbeinu made a mistake, the Ribbono Shel Olam would have corrected him. Why? How could it be that Moshe Rabbeinu made a mistake, that Bezalel had to correct him? Secondly, maybe Moshe Rabbeinu did it on purpose, like to test Bezalel, right? So who said he had a right to do such a thing? Right? It says that a Rebbe is allowed to do that with a Talmud, to keep him sharp, keep him on his toes. He's allowed to say something that's not right, and hoping that the Talmud will catch him and ask him and whatever to sharpen the wits of the Talmud. But we're talking about Moshe Rabbeinu giving the Torah to Klal Yisrael. Right, it wasn't time for games, and maybe Bezalel wouldn't catch him. So that also is not possible. So what does it mean? And thirdly, Bezalel, tzel is always a euphemism for doubt. Tzilo shel safek. There's no shadow of a doubt, even in English like that. Shadow of a doubt. On the other hand, light is a symbol of clarity. So if Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to say, "Hey, you really knew what the Ribbono Shel Olam said. You were then in the light of God," he should have called him Orkel, not Bezalel. Why Bezalel? You were in the shadow of God? You were in the light of God. Why the shadow? Shadow has an opposite connotation. So to answer it, I wanted to say the following, and fits in with this, what we have said, this idea of the physical both being the thing that initiates the spiritual, and then on the other end expresses it. Before the Chet HaEgel, before they sinned with the sin of the golden calf, the Ribbono Shel Olam said, "Kol hamakom asher asker shmi avoy lecha v'irachticha." You don't need a special place in the world where God's presence can be felt, but you could feel God's presence everywhere. Wherever you mention God's name, there, what's it called? I'll be there. You can feel my presence everywhere. Didn't have to be localized to a Mishkan or a Mikdash or whatever. Everywhere they would have felt God's presence. On the other hand, there was still supposed to be a Mishkan even before the sin of the golden calf. So what was the purpose of the Mishkan before the sin of the golden calf? You didn't need a place to go to feel God's presence, but you needed a place to go that you could feel God's presence everywhere in the world. But you had to have a place to express it, to express that relationship. So there was a Mishkan with the Kelim, with the various vessels that expressed your feeling of the closeness of the Ribbono Shel Olam in a positive, in a physical way, by lighting the menorah, by putting the bread on the shulchan, and so on. You expressed it in a physical way. So before the sin of the golden calf, right, the Mishkan's purpose would have been not to arouse your feeling of God's presence, but to express that feeling that you got anywhere in the world. So therefore, before the sin of the golden calf, the Mishkan was not the main thing. The main thing were the kelim, were the vessels. And the vessels just created a stronger feeling of God's presence. But the vessels came first, and then the Mishkan. So when God commanded Moshe Rabbeinu about the Mishkan, it was before the sin of the golden calf. But God knew that there was going to be a sin. And after the sin of the golden calf, you needed the Mishkan to arouse you to a feeling of the Ribbono Shel Olam's presence. You couldn't get it everywhere. You needed that physical plant to arouse you, to initiate that feeling. Couldn't get it everywhere in the world. You needed the physical to the emotions to create the emotions. And then to express it in a physical way through the kelim. So after the sin of the golden calf, it's clear that the Mishkan came first and then the kelim. And when Moshe Rabbeinu was told this mitzvah, God knew that he was going to have to make the order Mishkan and then kelim. But he couldn't tell Moshe Rabbeinu that. Because if Moshe Rabbeinu knew that the Mishkan came before the kelim, he would understand that there's going to become some kind of sin. Because at this point, that's not what's necessary. At this point, the kelim come before the Mishkan. So the Ribbono Shel Olam obscured his command to Moshe and made it appear to him as if the Mishkan came first, as if the kelim came first, in order not to hint to him that there's going to be a sin. So he said it in a clouded way, in an obscure way, that Moshe could make that mistake on purpose and not understand that really it means the Mishkan and then the kelim. When he told it over to Bezalel, it was after the sin of the golden calf. When he finally came down from Har Sinai after 120 days, after the sin of the golden calf. And then Bezalel said, that can't be. When the Ribbono Shel Olam told you, he told you in an obscure way, right? He clouded it, shadowed it, in order that you shouldn't understand there's going to be a sin of the golden calf. But this is not Minhago Shel Olam, this is not the way of the world now. Because the way of the world now is that we need the Mishkan first to arouse us to God's presence before we can use the kelim to express our feeling of God's presence. And that's what Moshe Rabbeinu said, B'tzel Kel, you understood that shadow of God that he obscured from me, what he really meant, because he didn't want me to know that the status was going to change. And therefore, you understood that really what he meant to tell me was the Mishkan and then the kelim, based on the fact that he knew there was going to be a sin of the golden calf, and God's knowing does not interfere with people's free choice beyond our understanding, but it doesn't. But Moshe Rabbeinu's understanding would have interfered. So Moshe couldn't know. So God Bedavka obscured this idea with Moshe Rabbeinu, and Bezalel understood. Bezalel, you were in the shadow of God. You understood that God shadowed this and made it obscure in order that I shouldn't understand, but really it means Mishkan and then Kelim. With that, I want to explain something else also. In Parshas Truma, in Parshas Kisisa, where it's still before the sin of the golden calf, where God is talking to Moshe Rabbeinu on Har Sinai before the sin of the golden calf, so he mentions the Mishkan, and then after that he mentions the mitzvah of Shabbos. In Parshas Vayakel, after the sin of the golden calf, where now Moshe Rabbeinu is telling over the command to the Jewish people, he changes the order. And he speaks about Shabbos first and then the Mishkan. Now Chazal say the fact that Shabbos precedes the Mishkan in Vayakel teaches me that Shabbos precedes the Mishkan. You can't build the Mishkan on Shabbos. That Shabbos takes precedence over the Mishkan. It would follow that if we only had the Parsha of Kisisa, where Shabbos comes after the Mishkan, we say just the opposite. That building the Mishkan supersedes Shabbos, and you can build the Mishkan on Shabbos. So why would it be that when God gave the command, he gave it in the opposite order that Moshe Rabbeinu gave it over? Based on this idea, I say the following. Why can't you build a Mishkan on Shabbos? Right? I mean, obviously, the Mishkan involves doing malacha, because those are the malachas that are awesome. So building the Mishkan is something that's prohibited on Shabbos. But so is making sacrifices, something that's prohibited on Shabbos. You have to light fires, and you have to cook the meat, right? So lighting the menorah, you light the menorah on Shabbos, right? So why is it okay to make sacrifices and desecrate the Shabbos for the sake of sacrifices or the menorah or the shulchan, right? And you burn the incense on the shulchan on Shabbos, and building the Mishkan is not allowed. Why? So the idea could be the following. Why is building the Mishkan prohibited on Shabbos? Because the Mishkan is there to make you feel God's presence. Shabbos brings God's presence into the world. So building the Mishkan on Shabbos would be an affront to Shabbos, as if Shabbos isn't enough to make you feel God's presence. Just like you don't wear tefillin on Shabbos, because tefillin is a sign of God's connection to us, and Shabbos is a sign. And wearing tefillin would say that Shabbos is not enough of a sign. So therefore, you don't wear tefillin on Shabbos not to be an affront to the sign of Shabbos. So building the Mishkan, if the purpose of the Mishkan is to bring God's presence into the world, then you don't build the Mishkan on Shabbos, because Shabbos brings God's presence into the world. Why do you need the Mishkan? On the other hand, serving the Shechinah, not bringing it into the world, but serving it doesn't contradict Shabbos at all. I can serve God's Shechinah on Shabbos, and that's not an affront to Shabbos. So you can bring sacrifices on Shabbos, and you can make the incense on the lechem and light the candles and everything. That's service of the Shechinah. But to bring Shechinah, that's an affront to Shabbos. So before the Chet HaEgel, like we explained, the purpose of the Mishkan was not to bring God's Shechinah into the world. It's everywhere. It was only to serve it with the Kalim. That was the main purpose. Therefore, you could build the Mishkan on Shabbos, because the whole purpose of building the Mishkan is service to Hashem, not bringing His presence into the world. So it didn't contradict and conflict with Shabbos. Only after the sin of the golden calf, then the purpose of the Mishkan was also to bring God's presence into the world. Now it's an affront to Shabbos. Now you can't build it on Shabbos anymore. So before the sin of the golden calf, Shabbos would have taken back seat to the Mishkan. After the Chet of Hegel, the Mishkan took a backseat to Shabbos. Okay, that's that. Okay, so let's go a little bit more on the Mesillas Yesharim. Even though God doesn't need our honor, and our honor is meaningless to Him, however, doing a mitzvah without that honor, without something that we can appreciate as an honorable thing, is sinning. This is what the prophet Malachi complains. Bidvar Hashem, the chisagishun iver lisboach, ein ra, hakriveil nolepechasecha, hayirtze o hayisha panecha. You bring me blemished animals to make as sacrifices. Blind, whatever, blind animals or whatever. Okay? And you think there's nothing wrong with that. Because what does God care if the animal's blind or not? Am I sure killing the animal and sacrificing it? What in the world does make a difference to God if it's a blemished animal or not? He says, why don't you bring it to your general or to your officer? You know, you ought to bring him a present. Bring him a blind, see what he thinks. Right? Not that God makes a difference to God, but it makes a difference to you. How you appreciate what you're doing. And if you bring something blind or whatever, you don't have the same honor, because you're affected by what you see. Right? And you see a blemished animal, so you feel that serving God is a blemished thing. But if you bring something nice, it makes a nice impression on you, and you feel that serving God is a refined thing, is an honorable thing. So, just like you wouldn't bring it to a human being, don't bring it to God. Not because it makes a difference to God, because it makes a difference in how you approach and how you what your feelings are towards the Rabbanu Shalom.
That's what happened to Cain.
What?
That's what
happened
to Cain. That? What
happened
to Cain?
Well, he's going to mention that in a few seconds. The Amru Chazal is Yironali Snai Hefef Zebavoda. The Amru Be'inyan Mainshin is Galu. Even something that there's no real problem with, it's just not nice. Right? You have what's it called? Water that was left open where there are snakes, poisonous snakes. So the halacha was that if it's in a place where poisonous snakes are usual, you can't drink that water if it was left open long enough for a snake to go in and drink from it, because we're afraid that maybe there's venom in the water. But the halacha is that if you filter the water, so with a filter that could take out the venom, you're allowed to drink that water. It's not usher anymore. But you can't use it for a mitzvah. You can't use it for you can't bring it to the Beis HaMikdash and use it for water for the karbonos or whatever. Why? Right? Even though for a regular person you're allowed to drink that water, but it's not. It's still water that once was possibly contaminated, and you had to filter it. That's not something that brings feelings of honor to the karbanos that you're bringing. If you're using it to serve the rabbanos with it, it has to be something that has no taint of any feeling of contamination or whatever. There's no actual nothing wrong with it. You're not poisoning God or whatever. It's perfectly okay. It's good water. It was filtered. A regular person allowed to drink it. That's not honorable. You don't bring somebody you want to give an important present. You don't bring him water that you had to filter because it may have been contaminated. You bring him something nice. You don't bring him second-rate things. Bring him first-rate things. And not because it makes a difference to him, because it makes a difference in how you approach and how you feel about that person. If you bring him second-rate things, then your feelings for that person are second-rate. And if you bring important things, you feel important towards that person. That's the idea.
The difference is this is Hashem we're talking about. Like it's
right, but again, it's not... Right, but it's not. But it's not for God's sake. But it's not for God's sake. It's because you're affected by what you are involved with. If you bring something second class, right, you feel second class. You feel that what you're doing is second class. It's not all that important because I can be Yotze with a second class thing.
Why is a blemished one considered second class?
Because a person sees an animal that has a broken leg, or blind, right, or something that's obviously not a perfect animal, right? You feel that you're bringing something that's imperfect to the Rabbanu Shalom, right? It's you want to feel that the service of the Rabbanu Shalom is a perfect thing, and if you bring something that is blemished, you don't feel that perfection, right? This could be the same reason why a Kohen, who's blemished, can't be an Ovid. Because, like it or not, people look at that Kohen who's blemished, right? He's missing an arm or whatever. He's blind in one eye or whatever. So he has a blemish, right? People, relate to Avodas Hashem that Kohen represents as something less than perfect. Because the Kohen, right, even he could be a perfect person, and he's not possible for anything. He could be the biggest gadol in the Klal Yisrael, and be missing an arm, right? But in the Avodah Space HaMikdash, where he's a representation of the Rabbanu Shalom, he's not teaching you, right? He's representing God. What he does represents, so you get a feeling that God's service is not perfect. There's something imperfect about it, because you're affected by what you see. It's impossible not to be. Even though intellectually you know that there's nothing wrong with this Kohen just because he's missing an arm, it's not his fault, right? His mother may have taken thalidomide when she was pregnant or whatever, and he was born without an arm. So it's not his fault, right? But the mice, it's what's it called? When you see that person, it conjures up feelings of imperfection. That's, you're a human being. You're affected by that. It's not shaykh not to be affected like that. Okay, we'll continue with this idea, but the next thing is about Cain and Hevel, so I want to speak a little bit about what was exactly Cain thinking of. Why did he bring second-rate things? And why was he so upset afterwards that the Muslim didn't accept it? Lamaish, you brought second-rate things, so, and your brother brought first-rate things. What was this Havamina? Why was he upset? He should have understood. Okay, it's my fault. That we'll see next week.
On the other hand, it makes people feel that somebody who is physically less than perfect does not have the same chashivas as somebody who's physically perfect. And that's not, dafka is a midah that people are supposed to be feel close to those who are nabach.
Okay, that's why I was careful to say that even though he could be the Gadol Bisrael, teach you Torah, it's not an achnami. You're supposed to not feel a mamzer Talmud Chacham is greater than the Kohen Gadol Amharetz, right? But that's where you're dealing not with that person as a representation physically of the Rabban Shalom servant. You're dealing with him on an intellectual plane. You're learning from him, right? You're dealing with him as a human being, not as a body. So in that respect, what difference does it make what his body is like? Just the opposite, right? You're supposed to look beyond the body. But with the Kohen is a physical representation of God in the Beis HaMikdash. He wears special clothing. The clothing can't be dirty, because if they're dirty, it gives you a dirty feeling about Avodas Hashem. That's dirty. What difference does it make if the clothing is dirty or not? But it affects you. You see a Kohen with dirty clothes, right? It makes you feel. And there you have to relate not to the spiritual side of the Kohen, you have to relate to the physical side of the Kohen. It's the Kohen in his body that is doing the service in the Beis HaMikdash. He's the one who's dressed up in those fancy clothing or whatever, right? He's supposed to make an impression on you. So the impression is not complete if it's an imperfect thing. But anything else about that person, where you're not dealing with the person's body per se, right? You're dealing with his chochma or whatever, there it's a different story. It could be the Sanhedrin also. A dayan, a regular judge, so the main thing of the judge is only that he paskin shilas. So it doesn't make a difference if he's blemished or not. But to be part of the Sanhedrin, you can't be blemished. Because the Sanhedrin is not just for what they say, it's what they are. The Sanhedrin itself represents the highest level of Torah in Klal Yisrael. So there also, it's more who they are and what they represent physically, and therefore physically it makes a difference. So Maisi can't say that it doesn't make an impression on you. It does make an impression. But where it has nothing to do with the physical, a physical dayan, what do you care what the dayan looks like? The main thing is what he says. So therefore you should ignore what he looks like. But if what he looks like is what is important, right? It's the physical representation of something. Whether it's a Sanhedrin, the Kohen, or whatever, there a blemish makes a difference.
Well, it's not the same thing as saying that, you know, the clothing of the Kohen is there. It has to be the Kohen little sefaris. It's something that's in your hands to do. And if you're lazy or whatever, you don't care enough to make sure that he's the Kohen little sefaris, then it's imperfection on the person who's wearing it.
Let's say the Kohen didn't do anything wrong.
No, well, he did.
Some of the blood spurted from the carbon on him.
But he has to. Then he has to change his. He has to.
Yeah, but we're not blaming him. But we're not blaming him for it.
No, but here it's
the Rebbeinu Shlomo.
The Rebbeinu Shlomo created the person with the mumps.
Right.
And then we're saying that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created him imperfectly. And if you take it to the extreme,
he created him imperfectly physically. That's true. And there was a reason for it.
And so by taking that to an extreme, it plays into the hands of some ideologies, which maybe don't have to be enumerated, where if somebody was less than perfectly formed, they were meant to be destroyed.
Yeah, but it has nothing to do with that. Now, looking at that person as a human being, as a person, right, as whatever, a functioning whatever, you have to look beyond the mum, and the person's a person despite the fact that they're blemished. But where that person, his body, right, his person, represents something, okay, it's impossible not to feel, looking at that person, that something's imperfect. There's a reason why it's imperfect. You can't blame him. There's nothing wrong with him, right? And he can function 100% okay. And you can deal with his functioning 100% okay, right? But Lamaisa, you're affected by his physical appearance in a way that is negative. It's impossible not to be. You're a human being. And you're affected by what you see. And therefore, where that person has to represent physically the Ribbono Shel Olam, Avodas Hashem, or an animal that has to be used as an object in Avodas Hashem, then it can't be something that affects you in a way that you feel is that object that represents HaKadosh Baruch Hu is imperfect. On the other hand, when you're dealing with a person as a person, not as an object, right? That's the best thing, I think. When the person becomes an object, then it's a problem. But most of the time, we don't deal with people as objects. We deal with them as people, right? So then, as people, there's nothing wrong with a person. It's not his fault. There's nothing wrong with him, right? He could be the biggest Talmud Chacham in the world. You can learn tremendous things from him or whatever. But then you're not dealing with an object. You're dealing with him as what he is doing, not what he is. But as a Kohen, you're dealing with him as what he is. As an animal for a sacrifice, what it is. As a Sanhedrin, what they are, that 71 people represent as a body, is what they are. That already is what they represent. It's impossible not to be affected if you see something that's imperfect. Or dirty or whatever, it makes an impression on you. And these people are supposed to be an object that's supposed to make the other opposite impression, and therefore it doesn't go together. Those philosophies and the ideologies say there's something wrong with the person. As a person, there's no purpose. His purpose isn't there. That's ridiculous. The purpose is there. He can't be an object of representation of Kedusha, of the Ribbono Shel Olam, or whatever. Right? So as an object, he can't be an object. But people aren't supposed to be objects all the time. The reason why they're alive and what gives them importance is not the fact that they're an object. What gives the Kohen importance is not the fact they could be a Kohen Ovid. He could be a fine human being. He's just not a Kohen. It could be Ovid in the Beis HaMikdash and be that object representation of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Two separate inyanim. A little bit, you hear?
I think Rav Chaim Kanievsky, he has his menorah. It's a very pashut menorah. He uses, people use very pashut as a mila. I look at it as a mila.
Well, it depends what, again, aesthetically, it doesn't mean, what's it called? Look, there's, aesthetics is very subjective. What purity to you? Some people like ostentatious things, what's it called? And some people like simple things, right? A silver menorah is a hither. A gold menorah could be even more than that, right? Shiloh, whether it's silver, but whatever it is, right? Obviously, it's better than a tin one, right? But that's very subjective. But there are certain things that are not so subjective at all that most people would look at as garbage. There's a famous story recently, a few years ago, of a guy who came to the janitor came to clean up the modern art museum. And threw away one of the major exhibits because he thought it was garbage.
He was right.
Right. Probably right. So it's any normal person would look and see that it's garbage. It's not what's it called. But somebody calls it art. Yeah.
Wouldn't we learn from Hashem though if that instead of kavod, like if it's for us, so instead of the kavod for it, we would learn sensitivity if he loves his blemished animals more than or as much as the other. Do you know what I'm saying? Like instead of this.
Yeah, but that is true, but it's true only in a spiritual sense. Again, we're human beings, so the Ribbono Shel Olam deals with us as we are. He created us to be affected for various reasons. By what we see, what we hear, by what we sense, we live in a physical world. So, and there's a reason why we have to be affected like that. But it affects us across the board. Right? And therefore, the Ribbono Shel Olam said, when you're dealing with physical things that appear to be imperfect, it makes an impression on you of imperfection. On the other hand, when you're dealing with spiritual things, there it says that the Ribbono Shel Olam deals with broken kelim. A person who feels broken, who feels disabled spiritually, is, the Kotzker Rebbe says, the most perfect thing is a broken heart. Because there it doesn't affect you physically. There you can intellectually understand that a person who feels broken is adarava. The person who feels he's complete is nothing. But that's when you're dealing intellectually. But when you're dealing with something that you see, it's very difficult to make your intellect overpower what you see, because it's the way the world is made, and the Rebbeinu Shem made it for a purpose like that. What you see makes more of an impression than what you know. And just in a few examples, one clear example, right, where what you know doesn't make the same impression as what you see, and just the opposite. What you see, what's it called, even though you know that it's not like that, what you see makes more of an impression. Where Paro, okay, it says that the Rebbeinu Shem killed the Jews who had to be killed in Mitzrayim during the 3 days of Choshech. That Paro shouldn't see Jews dying and say, you see, it's not just us, it's them too. So I would understand if 3 or 4 Jews died, they could do it under the cover of darkness, and when the lights went on, Paro would never know. But 4/5 of the Jewish people died. Before the lights went out, Paro saw 3 million Jewish men in Mitzrayim. 3 days later, there's 600,000 left, the cemeteries are full, you don't have to be too much of a genius to figure out what happened, right? These people died, right? 4/5 of the Jewish people died. What did the Rebbeinu Shem gain by doing it in under darkness? I think the answer is very simple. If Paro would have seen Jews dying, it would have made a tremendous impression on him, because what makes an impression is what you see. But now he never saw it. Now he can also deduce it intellectually. It doesn't make the same impression. It's not the same thing. What you see makes more of an impression than what you know. The example we always give with the park bench. You see, what's it called? You intellectually know that the paint is wet because it says wet paint. But until you touch it and feel it on your finger, it's not the same thing. Why are we made like that? You can't ask a question like that, because there's many positive reasons. So when the Rebbeinu Shem puts a power into nature, he doesn't limit it. It's across the board. So because he wants us to be affected by what we see, by what we sense, we are affected by what we see and what we sense that's less than perfect in an imperfect way. Intellectually, you can understand that that imperfection may be the perfection of the person, that's only intellectual. They still affect you on the sensory level in a negative way. Even though intellectually you can say now, no, just the opposite. That person with that handicap, and look what they can do, right, that makes it much greater. But that's intellectual. It's not the same thing as what you see and what affects you by seeing. It's even better, I think. In those intellectual, you could feel that Kohen is just as perfect as anybody else. But what you see affects you. And the Torah didn't want that what you see should affect you in Avodas Hashem, that even that, in that realm, it shouldn't affect you and give less covet to and feel imperfection by the Rebbeinu Shlom. That's it. And it's not so much that something's wrong, it's just not perfect. Because the Sfarno points out there are certain blemishes that make the animal better. Right? That sometimes you blemish the animal on purpose, which is considered a blemish and it can't be a sacrifice, but it makes the animal fatter, stronger, bigger, that blemish. Right? And it's still not good. Why? Because true, it's nicer, bigger, fatter, but it's not perfect. There's something imperfect about it, and that's the main thing in Avodas Hashem, how you attribute perfection to the Rebbeinu Shlom, not imperfection. That's all. And even though intellectually you can feel differently, but you're still affected by what you see. Okay, we'll continue next week in Avodas Hashem.